Actually, we're living in the context now where people are beginning to claim that they also have a high view of scripture, but are coming to different conclusions on some of these matters. So I don't think we could take anything for granted in that. And that's one of the reasons, among others, that we've chosen to kind of add this and really to be crystal clear on where we stand.
Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham. I'm Executive Director of the FIEC, and I'm joined today by the Chair of our Trust Board, Ian Jones. Hello. Ian. Ian, also Pastor of Rotherham Evangelical Church.
Yeah, I thought we should have dressed up for Ian.
I've got a shirt on, that's okay, all I'll say. Excellent. And Adrian Reynolds, our Head of National Ministries, is here as well. Hello, Adrian.
Hello, but I'm not here in that capacity.
You are not. And this is interesting because we've just come away from a meeting of the Trust Board here at our headquarters, where we've been talking about changes to the FIEC doctrinal basis, one of our ethos statements, and our constitution. Now, this is something churches know about because we wrote to them in February, or Ian did, to explain the changes that we're looking at. These were trailed at the AGM during our leaders' conference last November. So if you're listening and you're not part of the FIEC, I hope this will be a helpful podcast to you, but we are really thinking about our affiliated churches in this conversation.
All churches that want to affiliate.
Yeah, indeed. Because we want to help people to understand why it is that the FIEC is considering these changes to the doctrinal basis, why we're considering a change to one of our ethos statements, and why we're considering a change to our constitution. So that's the basis of this conversation. And Adrian, you're here as a local church elder who might have questions about the process.
I think I'm here as a little bit more than that, Phil, because I think I'm here as a local church elder who's had the had all the information from me and the Trust Board, but may not have read it all.
Okay. So you're going to be asking questions.
Yeah, so I think you know, I may have skim read it, let's say, but, you know, I've changed the doctrinal basis when I saw what it was about. So, and I didn't really sort of delve into every jot and tittle. So I'm here to ask the stupid questions, really.
So, Ian, this email was sent to churches, I think, back into February.
End of March.
It was end of March, I beg your pardon. So sent at the end of March. You asked folk to come back to you, you've got eight weeks to take notes from people. So just tell us about the kind of process you've gone through as chair of the board in terms of engaging with churches about the changes in these three areas. We'll come on to what they are, but what's the process been like?
Yeah, I think, broadly speaking, it's been very encouraging. We set out as a board with the intention of this being a genuine conversation. We wanted to be open and transparent and for people to participate in that. I think I've been really encouraged by the number of responses, by the gracious tone of the responses, by the helpful, constructive comments that have come in. So I think I'm learning a lot as I've become chair of the board. A lot of what we do in our local church is very relational. When we do things at scale on a national basis, there is inevitably a distance and there's more formality involved. But I think this process is everything that we as a board wanted it to be in terms of it being constructive and encouraging and helpful.
And churches have come back to you? You've had responses from folk?
Yeah, I think it's been a little bit more work than I anticipated. I think there's been over 40 in responses from individuals in various churches across our constituency. And all of that has been helpful. I hope that I've replied to all of them. I'm slightly anxious that maybe one or two might have fallen through the net. Yep. If I haven't replied to you, that wasn't intentional. But I've had some good dialogue, some phone calls as well. And it all feels like it's been a really helpful, positive, encouraging process.
Just tell me out here, I'm an elder slightly on the edge, of life.
Not literally.
On the edge of the FIEC. Who are the board? Self-appointed, or where do they come from?
So 12 trustees that are appointed by the churches. So every year at the AGM, there are vacancies on the trust board, and churches nominate men from their churches who could serve on the FIEC.
Right, so that's how our accountability works.
Exactly right. So essentially, the trustees are...
So this isn't just a self-appointed group of grandees deciding something's going to change.
All appointed by the churches. It's just worth touching on your role as an elder, Adrian. As an eldership, did you discuss this when the email landed? Have you talked about it at local church level?
No,
that's fine. So you've not picked up on that. Is that because it wasn't received, do you think? Or is it the changes?
I think probably because several of us in the church work for the FIEC.
That's fine. Okay, fair enough.
As it happens, we've also been going through a process of changing our own basis of faith and changing our constitution to reflect similar things. So, and maybe we'll talk about that a bit later.
Yeah.
Excellent. So the board have now met to kind of finalise what these changes look like. So why don't we take them in turn and talk a bit about the changes that are being proposed and why they're being proposed. Yeah. So the big one really is the change to the doctrinal basis. So if you're not aware of this, the FIC has a basis of faith. This is a doctrinal statement, which has been in place for several decades. And then there are three ethos statements.
Does it not go back 100 years?
It doesn't, no. So I think it was the early 90s that it was last...
Okay, so it's a fluid...
Once in a generation, probably we're looking at the doctrinal basis. Then there are ethos statements that churches sign up to as well. But probably the biggest change is we're making an addition, aren't we? Or we're proposing an addition to the doctrinal basis. Ian, just outline to us what that addition is and why we're making it.
Yeah. I think one of the drivers for this is to be really clear on our beliefs about marriage. And in the culture that we're in, part of the driver for that is to demonstrate that these are part of our core beliefs and not kind of a secondary issue that's kind of a sidebar. Part of the rationale for that is that could potentially strengthen some protections under equality legislation. I think the bigger driver is really theological clarity. We're aware of the danger of the word fluid. We don't want to be changing our doctrinal basis too frequently, but there are issues that come along. You talked about once in a generation that are serious. I think there are things that we can't take for granted and assume maybe in this current context. And it feels helpful to us as a board to be really clear theologically on where we stand on the issue of marriage.
So is it having its own little section, or is it?
Yeah, we've talked about this a lot as a board. I think we have chosen not to add a separate paragraph on marriage for a couple of reasons. One is because we don't want it to look like the beginning of a potential list of new paragraphs every time there's a cultural issue that we might feel the need to respond to. That's not the intention here. And I think, secondly, we don't want it to look like a negative response, a defensive posture. We've tried to redraft the paragraph that really speaks about creation and about humans being made in God's image. And to not use negative words or to single out particular people or groups, we essentially just want to make a positive statement about God's creation ideal, about humanity and marriage as a part of that. So I think we felt that was slightly softer than having a separate paragraph that could potentially look like more of a knee-jerk reaction to a cultural moment. So hopefully that's a positive redraft rather than a kind of a knee-jerk, a reactionary addition that looks more negative and defensive.
Can you read it out? Is there any short? Can someone read it out for us?
Yeah. So essentially we're...
you've got a nice radio voice.
I've got to try and find my paperwork to make sure that I've got it in the place that I was expecting it to be.
Does that mean he's not got a face for TV?
Yeah. it's on there, isn't it? Yeah, there we go. Sorry, I don't know why I've not got it in front of me, but here we are. So essentially we've got a section 3 on humanity, then a section 4 on the fall.
Okay.
We're proposing the humanity section say this: all men and women being created in the image of God have inherent and equal dignity and worth. Their greatest purpose is to obey, worship, and love God. God created us male and female as identified by our biological sex. Marriage is the exclusive union of one man and one woman, and is a picture of the relationship between Christ and his bride, the church. Sexual intimacy is a gift from God to be enjoyed only within the context of marriage. So that's sitting under the section on humanity, talking about the created order. And then section 4 on the fall will say this, and this is very similar to what's already there, I think. As a result of the fall of our first parents, every aspect of human nature has been corrupted, and all men and women are without spiritual life, guilty sinners and hostile to God. Every person is therefore under the just condemnation of God and needs to be born again, forgiven and reconciled to God in order to know and please him. And it's important, I think, isn't it, Ian, that, that the reason for this change as well is to link it to our core beliefs about the gospel. Yes. And about how marriage points to the gospel. Can you just help us to unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, I think we've talked about this a lot as well. There are clearly all kinds of issues that we could potentially add to a document like this. I think...
Yeah, and that's helpful to me because I'll have people in the church who are saying, well, hang on, why isn't there a statement on this or that, euthanasia or abortion or, you know... Why this and not that?
Yeah, I think there's a sense in which, broadly speaking, I think there are other issues that people might come to different conclusions on. I think this issue is much more serious than that and does fall into the category of a gospel issue. And I think that's one of the reasons that we wanted to add this and not create a list of appendices that deal with lots of other issues. So, some secondary issues are more important than others, but this one is a core gospel issue, we think, and it's important for us to be clear on that. Well, I think one example of that is that I think some people in their responses very helpfully said that does our current doctrinal basis not assume this because we have a high view of Scripture? Yeah. And does it not follow... Actually, we're living in a context now where people are beginning to claim that they also have a high view of Scripture, but are coming to different conclusions on some of these matters. So I don't think we could take anything for granted in that. And that's one of the reasons, among others, that we've chosen to kind of add this and really to be crystal clear on where we stand.
And marriage is a picture of the gospel as well, isn't it? So yep. Christ and his bride, the church.
Yeah, the statement... did say that and does say that. So we want to highlight that that is a gospel issue, Christ and his church. That's the gospel, and marriage is a picture of that rather than the other way around. So, yeah.
It used to be, we used to talk about this a lot. There was an ethos statement, isn't it, about same-sex marriage. Yeah. I enjoyed signing that. We all say, by the way, that although we are a network of churches, we'd always to have a pastor's network and members of the pastor's network also sign the doctrinal basis and ethos statements, as do staff. As a church leader, though, I like that ethos statement. Lots of room for detail. You can expand some bits rather than just trying to think how do you condense things into a sentence. What's the value of having in the doctrinal basis rather than ethos statement? We sign both. So why here and not there? And is it replacing ethos statement? Is all that detail gone now?
Yeah, I think as a board, our kind of proposal is that we keep the existing ethos statement. I think there's a lot of helpful stuff in there. I think that's a slightly different document. We've talked a lot about this. I think it's possible that someone could come to a conclusion, I can sign up to a statement of faith. I kind of get what's in the ethos statement, but that's not going to stop me potentially having fellowship with the church down the road that take a different view on some of these issues. I think one of the reasons we're adding this to our doctrinal basis is that we want to make clear that that's a boundary for us.
It's not secondary at that level.
It's not secondary at that level. Okay. It's not kind of an optional kind of thing that we can agree to disagree on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think making that clear in terms of boundary will help us as we look forward.
Got it.
But the ethos statement contains a lot of good stuff. We don't want to put all of that into a doctrinal statement.
No.
But I think having that there as a document that's helpful pastorally, I think there's some good wisdom in there.
Is it changing the ethos statement or does it remain the same?
Okay. Yeah, we'll remain. Yeah, this process has...
So if I could sign, so I'm just being, perhaps I'm being a bit thick here, but if I could sign the ethos statement before, I'm not talking about, you know, philosophical ideas about where things should be, but in terms of theology, if I could sign the ethos statement, I can now sign the basis of faith.
Absolutely.
It's not introducing something new for me.
Not introducing anything new. And I think one of the things that we've been reflecting on as a staff team and then the board has been reflecting on as well is that the ethos statement helps to clarify our fellowship. That's what it's there for. So it clarifies what we believe about what will be. So it's clarifying what will now be if these changes are approved in the doctrinal basis.
Got it.
So in the same way, the statement on gospel unity and ecumenism, it clarifies what we mean about who we'll have partnership with. In the same way that the women in ministry statements clarifies what we mean about the you know, created male and female. So it's in a similar vein.
Okay.
It clarifies our fellowship. And I think that's a helpful way of thinking about it. So there's no reason if you've signed the DB and the ethos statements before, these changes should not lead to you feeling that you couldn't sign them going forward.
Okay. No.
Is that fair?
And similarly for a church, you know, I think he's a church leader really. And I guess this is a question about, you know, lots of churches, especially newer churches, will have the FIC basis of faith as their basis of faith.
Yes.
But perhaps because they've been set up since the last time it was changed, or perhaps because they're kind of, you know, very enthusiastic members of the FIC and, you know, and want to share that and think it's a well-written, I thought it is a well-written doctrinal basis. So do you think a church should change its doctrinal basis now? I mean, as it happens, we are, but we are doing it actually as a separate process. We decided that was a good thing to do. But should a church be thinking about changing its doctrinal basis? So I understand there's no problem for a pastor signing the annual renewal every year. He's not signing up to something he hasn't signed up to before.
Yeah.
He doesn't need to go to the church and say, hey, everybody, we've now got to sign up to a statement on same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
It's just changed where it is.
Yeah.
But should I be thinking about changing our doctrinal basis? Is that just good wisdom for a church?
Yeah, I think there's a few things in play there. I think there's a, yeah, first of all, I think what we're doing here is we are defining a statement of faith for the FIC.
Right.
And I think you're right, that doesn't meet, when churches do that annual renewal, that's the statement of faith that they'll be agreeing to, and that shouldn't be a problem for our existing family of churches and new ones that agree with that. I don't think that necessarily means that our individual churches need to adopt this new statement of faith. One or two respondents in this process have asked a question about what would that mean for people in their church who maybe might not yet be, maybe new Christians who might not yet be in a position where they've come to that view. I think that would be a matter for an individual local church. If a church was concerned about that, they're not forced to adopt this statement of faith. I think this is an FIC statement. Some of our churches will want to adopt it. And there is a second thing in play where I think some of our churches may have a situation where constitutionally they just refer to the FIC statement of faith as their statement of faith.
Right.
And so we need to take a little bit of advice from Edward Connor on those matters, whether that automatically kind of upgrades your statement of faith or whether it was at the point at when you signed your constitution that it was the statement of faith that applied then. I'm not sure that that will affect many of our churches.
No.
Because I think most of our churches will have a separate statement of faith. But we can help with that, and we need to take some advice from ECS on that.
Yeah. Edward Connor Solicitors, a firm of solicitors, just worth saying.
Thank you.
Edward Connor and ECS.
using acronyms. This bloke Edward is just sitting outside the room. He's going to give us some advice.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. We need to take some advice on that in the small minority of cases where that would be in play. Yeah.
And it is worth saying, isn't it, in church life, and we feel this, that new converts don't understand everything about the gospel. And, you know, I mean, this is a particular issue that has a cultural moment.
Yes.
But there are other things in our basis of faith that I wouldn't expect a new convert to know, understand, even believe.
Yes.
You know, actually, you know, the bar for becoming a Christian in scripture is relatively low, in the sense of you haven't got to sign up to this doctrinal position or that doctrinal position.
Yeah.
It's about a living relationship with Jesus who died and was raised, and
and
you believe in him, you believe his Lord, you confess it with your lips that he's raised from the dead. So I think we've got to be careful, haven't we, that as church leaders generally, we don't place a burden on people to say you've got to believe everything. And churches just need to find a way around that for new believers. That's always been the case.
I think the other thing we've sought away is that there are two different categories of people who respond to this. Some will be maybe new converts who may not be landing in this particular place, and you've touched on that well. I think the other category of people who would be opposed to this kind of thinking and conclusion anyway, and whether this is in our doctrinal statement or in our ethos statement or both, is almost irrelevant at that point, because if you fundamentally don't agree with this as a position, it doesn't quite matter whether it's in the foreground or the background or where it is. I think for some in our culture, we can't disagree with where our culture's at nicely. If we take a different view, we're going to be thought ill of just by the fact that it's there. It doesn't kind of matter where it is. Mm. I think this is about clarity for us in terms of marking where some of those theological boundaries are. So that's helpful to think through as well.
So that's the doctrinal basis. That will come to the churches. We'll talk a bit about the process towards the end of the podcast. But the second thing you're looking at as a board is our statement, ethos statement on women in ministry. Now, just tell us why the board have had a look at that, because this is not a fundamental change. It's not changing the nature of what the statement says, but why are we having a look at this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when this statement was drafted, it was not in the minds of the people who originally drafted it that there would be debates, more recent debates, about the nature of the Trinity. It just wasn't in the minds of the draftees of this document. I think what's happened in recent years is that there are people on the complementarian and egalitarian side of these debates about the roles of men and women who have appeared. We're not saying as a board that we are not Trinitarian. And we totally recognize as a board that Paul does use Trinitarian arguments when he addresses some of this. The challenge is that there are different theologians on both sides of that debate who use those references to bolster their own arguments. And that's become a very heated debate, in particular about the nature of the Father and the Son and the submission that's involved in that, and whether that's temporary during Jesus' life incarnate or whether that's eternal and ontological. This statement is in no way, it was never intended to speak into that debate, but now it looks like it inadvertently is speaking into that debate. So I think what we're trying to do here is, without dismissing our Trinitarian beliefs, is to simplify. If we wanted this statement to speak into that, it would need to be about 5 pages longer, and it would have to be very nuanced. I think the board have come to the conclusion that the arguments from creation are strong enough for the purposes of this, and we're really trying to simplify the document.
So just, sorry, let me understand this.
Yes.
Little inconsequential elder over here. We're talking about essentially the way that the Son relates to the Father in eternity.
Yes.
And there'll be some people who think that changes with the Jesus coming to earth.
Yes.
And there'll be some people who think that's just a constant throughout all eternity.
Yeah.
And the FIC doesn't take a position on that. There's nothing else in the basis of faith about that. You could believe either of those and be a member of the FIC.
Is that correct?
Yeah. That's accurate.
And there are churches that believe either of those. So it's obviously a debate. It's ongoing and needs to be conducted, as all theological debates do, in gracious way. But it's not something that we differ over in the FIC. Is that right?
No.
Okay. So what we're doing here, let me just replay it to you, Ian, and see if I've understood it rightly. We're basically changing this statement so it doesn't look as though it's taking a side in that debate.
Correct.
Because it was never meant to.
Yes.
Okay.
But that's a good way to summarize what
the functional nature of the statements. The functional nature of the statement isn't changing.
It's
achieving the same thing.
Yes,
that's exactly right. And I think the presenting issue was there were some faithful guys in the network who were saying, "I'm not sure I can sign this anymore for the reasons we've just been outlining, or Ian's so well articulated." Okay. So that was why it came to the board for you guys to have a look at. Yeah. Wasn't
right?
It?
Got it.
Yeah,
got it.
I think in this process of dialogue with our churches, I think almost all the responses I've received have been warm and, "Can you just explain to me what we're doing?" And then when I've explained and talked through with individuals what I've just explained, the responses have been, "That makes sense and I'm totally fine with that."
Yeah.
So I think I said this once at the leaders' conference, if someone zoned out for 30 seconds and didn't pick that up, this process has been a good way to kind of just re-articulate. This is more about our broader unity than trying to speak into a sometimes heated but narrow debate that's going on.
Okay, that's helpful.
And we just don't want this document to be a stumbling block in unnecessary ways.
So it's got to do what it's meant to do rather than something it's not meant to do.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Excellent. So the final change that we're looking at is a much simpler one, but I'll just ask you to pick it up with us. So this is a change to our constitution.
Ooh, I'm excited.
I know.
Now.
Well, I know. but the constitution does not currently allow for FIEC to hold its annual general meeting electronically. And this was brought to the fore during COVID, wasn't it? Because we could meet online because the Charity Commission gave permission for us to do that. What's interesting is the Charity Commission are now saying you need to sort your constitutions out so that you can do online meetings in the future. Yeah. And if there were to be another pandemic, they're basically expecting charities to update their constitutions to allow for this to happen.
So please, that's what no more pandemics.
that's what we're seeking to do. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I think it goes slightly further than that as well. If we arranged our leaders' conference, for example, in Blackpool as well at the moment, and let's say maybe 6 weeks before we were due to meet, the conference centre burnt down and we weren't able to meet, what we're doing here is giving ourselves the provision in our constitution to be able to do our corporate governance online if that were needed in an emergency. So it's not just a pandemic. We hope we won't have another one. But there could be reasons why, and our constitution doesn't allow that at the moment. So we should make really clear, loud and clear, that we're not planning to use this to avoid having face-to-face AGMs. Our 100% preference is that we do this in person. But if on the rare occasions that we might be constrained to do it online, this is making it possible for us to do so.
Okay.
One or two people have actually asked in this process, does that mean that if people can't make the leaders' conference, they could Zoom in and we could make facilities for this to be hybrid? And the answer to that is no. We're not planning.
Oh, it does allow it.
Yes, yeah. But we're not planning to do it.
It allows it, but we're not planning to do it.
Yeah, we're not planning to make this hybrid. We want to take the view that it's good for us to do these things face-to-face, and that's our intention. So there's no ulterior motive here, in other words, for us to kind of pull back from that.
Okay, so we've got three changes then. So we've got this change to the doctrinal basis, which is adding in a section speaking to marriage. We've got the change to the Women in Ministry statement, which removes the concerns that have been raised around eternal functional subordination of the Son. And then we've got the change to the constitution about online AGM. So those three changes. Yeah. So what's the process now, Ian? What happens next?
Yes, so the process now is that we will send out a mailing in July, I think it is, that'll go out to all of our churches with the final kind of drafts of the things that we've already been talking about over this last quarter. And that is essentially a prelude to us then meeting in November. The reason that needs to go out early is because we've got to give notice of our AGM, and in particular, these changes to the constitution particularly need to be done in an extraordinary general meeting. So we'll need separate to our AGM to hold an EGM to agree these changes.
Lawyers love it, don't they?
Yeah.
I can see them.
Yes.
It's drooling at the mouth. Yeah.
Yes, it's not like hugely interesting. But the reason that needs to go out in July is to give notice that we'll be having an EGM in November. I think for these changes to pass, our delegates then will vote in the usual way. We need to reach a majority on that. And then there'll be processes beyond that in approving these things with the Charities Commission. But November is the time that we'll...
So if I want to vote, I've got to be there.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Essentially. Yeah.
No and that's then. And that's always the case, really.
Yeah, yes.
Because and the way we're currently constituted, we can't do it any other way anyway. So you'd have to be there. And I guess you'd take questions from the floor during that EGM. You'd hope a lot of the work has been done in terms of engagement with churches, but we'd take questions from the floor. It would be a transparent process in November.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when that goes out in July, if anyone's got any questions on the basis of what we've said today, feel free to be in touch. We want this to be open and constructive and engaging. So I think a lot of the groundwork has been done through this year, But we'll have some discussion in November and hopefully make some decisions.
Is it just a show of hands? How does it work? I've not been to the leaders' conference AGM. How does it work?
Yeah, so there's a
number of delegates per church, how does that work?
So it's I think I'm right in saying, I'd have to look at the constitution, but I think I'm right in saying it's different in an EGM to an AGM. So I think in an AGM, churches get a vote based on size of membership, whereas in an EGM, I think it's one church, one vote, but I might be wrong about that, so don't quote me on it. But I think it is slightly different in terms of voting, but we'd need to have sort of votes for different churches, and we've got some administrative work to do, Adrian, to make that.
And will there be comments at the AGM, EGM, or is the time for that then gone? It's just a vote.
No, I think we would take questions from the floor, wouldn't we? We want it to.
But we're voting on the proposals that have been made.
Yeah, that would be the plan that votes on this, because they were trailed last November. Obviously, now churches have been involved in the process of thinking this through with the board, and then it'll come to the AGM and the EGM in November.
I asked a question like this, but this is slightly different. This question: would you advise a church leader to tell the church, I'm coming along in November. I'm going to vote. I'm happy to vote for this. It all looks very sensible. In reality, nothing's actually changing in terms of doctrinal position. Would you advise me as a church leader to call a church meeting myself to say, this is, I'm just letting you know this is changing, or is it of not really that sort of consequence? I'm just sort of thinking, you know, there are churches where you could use up an awful lot of emotional capital in church life by taking that step. What would you counsel me, Ian?
I think many of the respondents to this process, some of them have responded individually. Some of them, I think, have met as leadership teams and discussed this. And I've been very grateful for the thoroughness in that. I'm not sure that needs to be a major conversation. I think that's a matter for each local church, isn't it?
And it will depend how the church is constituted as well.
It will.
So, for example, if you're a congregational church, you might have to bring the FIEC statement of faith before the church every year to reaffirm your commitment to the fellowship.
I mean, it's interesting the way you were talking about it being added to the doctrinal basis, because I wonder, from my point of view, it's almost as though it's been translated, to use an Anglican term. You know, it was in one statement, it's gone to another.
Yeah.
So it's not actually, from the church's point of view, from ordinary member, it's not actually that anything has changed. It's just being put in a different place where it's clear and doctrinally strong.
I think it's good for our church members to be aware of that as a change. Sure. Okay. But I think you're right. It's not a substantial change. Yeah. It's more about the location of where we're saying what we're saying, isn't it? And I think the underpinning of theological clarity that gives to us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if anyone's got questions about that, they can be in touch. Thank you.
And we do want to hear from people if you do have questions about it, because we're really keen that do write in.
Adrian,
this is a process that we want the churches involved in. We've tried to involve churches in it, and it is ultimately the church's decision, because they will vote on it in November. So hope you found that stimulating. I hope it's helped your understanding in why these changes are being made. And do pray for us as we draw that together in November, because it will be a large administrative task, and then the follow up to that will be a large task as well. So thank you for listening.
And do come.
In November. If you've not booked
dates,
yet, 6th to the 8th of November.
When does the early bird run out?
Early bird runs out. When this goes live, the early bird might already have run out, so I'm not prepared to give
what's after. What's after early bird? Just bird.
It's early bird, advance, and then standard.
Okay.
So advance runs till, I think, the end of September. So there we are. So do book, and the sooner you book, the more money you save on your conference ticket. So this has been Independence, the FIEC podcast. Do rate, leave a review so others can find it, and I hope this has been helpful. As we've discussed the upcoming proposed changes to our doctrinal basis, one of our ethos statements, and the Constitution. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Adrian.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll speak to you again.